Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear three other guys. John KC2 WGB, who handles the mailbag and monitors Echolink. You'll be hearing Paul WS2N with the space report. From time to time, you'll be hearing Hal K6DPZ, who has touched a lot of radio equipment in his very few years. The main purpose of the technical band, you guys know it, you've heard it for 32 years, if you've been listening from the very beginning, 1982, when it all began, is education. The clan of ham radio operators who are interested in real radio and real wireless and are curious. They gather every Sunday night for the last 32 years and teach each other how the transmitters work and receivers and antennas and transmission lines and propagation and the 32 or 35, I think it is. I've even forgotten. 28. I think it's 27 or 28 different kinds of ham radio. Lots of kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the kinds. And before you give up this most educational hobby, be sure you try one of the other kinds. Let me drop. We have, over those 32 years, developed a menu which has evolved, and it's subject to improvement if you think there's better ways we do it. During the first hour, we take questions from people who do have a question or a comment from the net, and we try to give them a quasi-brief answer. It's not always brief. Sometimes I'm pretty verbose, but I'd rather create a little more understanding than more confusion in giving people better explanations that are too brief. Hal, from time to time, will show me the more brief way of giving those explanations of how radio really works. After the first hour or so, that's followed by John with the mailbag. In other words, for people who don't yet have the right radio equipment or the right ham radio license, they can talk to us direct. They give John their emails, their snail mail, their pigeon droppings, and with their questions, and John will choose of the sometimes 75 letters he gets in a week, he will choose the ones that sound most general for further discussion. That's followed by Paul's space report, in which he tells us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. Paul has been tracking NASA. He's been interested in space ever since space was invented in 1958 when Sputnik was first launched. Let me drop. And Paul will be giving us a space report number 138 of the series later on tonight. This is TechNet number 1545 of the series that began in September of 1982. As such, the TechNet's been around a while. It's now being covered by the tri-state area by this particular repeater. Also, by way of Echolink and IRLP, there are people who are quite far out of the area in other states and other countries who from time to time sign in. We're going to periodically give a complete long drop, not only for the three or four beeps, but let the machine completely drop so that people out of the area have a chance to sign in if they so wish to do so. Also, by way of John monitoring the Echolink website, if he was able to bring that up tonight, he will be able to find out that you're trying to get your agent word-wise and we're not leaving a big enough pause, and he'll inform us of that. Let me drop. See, there are people who are quite... So, from time to time, you will be hearing things that shouldn't be there. What we recommend you do is to go to the reverse mode of your machine, of your receiver, so that you can hear the loudness and measure the signal strength of the signal that's there that shouldn't be there, and report it to LIMARC. There's at least two different ways you can report it to LIMARC. The one that was most popular in the past was, let me think now, what was that, all of a sudden I've forgotten the exact the website we're supposed to go to. It's, I think it's interference@LIMARC.org, or correct me on that one, John. You probably got a better memory than me. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
You got it, Dick. RFI. And now they have a new listing for it. I'm not sure what that is, but either one should do fine.
K2EO. It's abuse@LIMARC.org.
Positive in the pen. Very fine, John. one. So either at abuse@limerock.org or RFI, Radio Frequency Deterrent, RFI@limerock.org. You go to that particular website and report. What we want to hear about is how strong was the signal, where are you located, or where were you located when you heard it. If you happen to have a directional antenna, you can tell us the direction of arrival. That would be very helpful. And the time. When did you hear it? So we'd like to hear that information. Okay. I think that's our beginning announcements. I'll send out, does anybody have a general announcement that should be made tonight? In fact, there should be an announcement with reference to the flea market, that will flea market or convention, a Limerock get together at Levittown Hall that will be taking place on, I think it's March 8th, next Sunday, a week from today, starting at 9 o'clock in the morning, I believe it is, for general admission, 7 o'clock in the morning for people who are going to be sellers at the Levittown Hall. There'll be a gathering of people trading lots of equipment and lots of money. Maybe we'll give us any further report on the upcoming flea market convention, hammerama, whatever you want to call it. Give me your call, it is right now. K2LAW listening. And who are you, Dick? Please, on. Go ahead, Rich. Today, a week from today, starting at.
Sorry, Dick, I was trying to do two things. Were you taking check-ins?
Spellers. Okay, we've got a check-in from Rich in 2EO. A person who's going to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the net. You're going to give us a check-in right now. You don't have to check in because you're listening. After 32 years and about 5,000 hours of TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. There are more hours on the air of the TechNet than Johnny Carson was on the air in his 30 years. So right now we believe somebody is listening. You don't have to line in to say you're here. If you do have a question or a comment, give me your call, letters, and name right now. We've got Rich so far. Anyone else?
UJL.
Babylon. Okay, I heard UJL and I heard Babylon. Mr. UJL, give me your full call and name, sir.
So, Oscar November Yankee, KC2, United Juliet Lima.
KC2, United Juliet Lima. What is your handle, sir?
My name is Tony, and I do have a question, not pertaining to radio, Dick. Does it necessarily, if you have some information for the net, does it have to pertain just to radio solely? Or do you have, if you have some information pertaining to people's health in general?
We'll be the judge of that, Tony. We'll wait till we get to you. Not to worry. Okay, so far we've got Rich, Tony. There was another person trying to sign in. What's your call letters and name, sir?
Your time is up.
As you can see, Kilo Charlie 2, Fox, Yankee, KC2FY, the name is Wise, Whiskey India, Romeo, Sierra on Echo Link. Over.
Okay, we got Kilo Charlie 2, Foxtrot, Yankee, on Echo Link, and the man name is Wires. Very good. So far we've got as check-ins Rich, Tony, and Wires. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment, give me a call, letters, and name right now. K2RAW listening.
KZ, Philip.
Okay, it sounded like KMZ, Philip. Give me the rest of that, Philip. Give me the whole call letters.
And to KMZ, Philip. I'm over in West Hempstead, and I have a question.
Okay, November 2, Kilo Mike Zulu, Philip, in West Hempstead. Alrighty. And one last call. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. A little bit slowly, please.
US2N, Paul with a space report. Leaving Dick, John, now.
A quick comment on the hamfestic.
Go right ahead, Rich. I mean, John. We got you, Paul. And John, go right ahead about the hamfest.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I just want to remind everybody not to forget that Andy will be there with his little test setup, which a lot of people use that and appreciate that. So anybody who maybe have an HT or something they've purchased at contact us. Andy will be there. They'll be able to check it out. Just want to remind everybody about that. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah,
correct.
From some people's point of view, Andy's tune-up clinic at the Hamfest is one of the highlights. He almost always positions himself up on the stage to the rear left-hand corner of the building as you enter from the front door. And he's there with his service monitor, power output meter, spectrum analyzer, and so on. Lots and lots of guys can't resist the beautiful price for Baofengs and Waxon radios, and a certain percentage of them are being shipped to the new FCC standard, which is narrow band, so to speak. Not just narrow band, narrow band. In other words, the widest they'll go is 2.5 kc, in which case people will be complaining you've got low audio unless you are an eighth of an inch away from the microphone and shouting into it. So whether or not your particular Baofeng or Waxon or any other radio has the right amount of deviation for ham radio service, which is about plus or minus 5 kc, whether or not you're meeting that so-called ham radio standard, you go to visit Andy with your radio. He's got power supplies to power your mobile rig. He's probably even got batteries to power your handy talkie. And so check it out, if you know what I mean. Talk into it. He looks at it on his service monitor and lets you know whether or not it needs modification. And a significant, let me drop. So whether or not you're Baofeng or Waxon, a significant number of people have written letters to, have created a website with various methods of modifying those inexpensive radios to bring them up to more full modulation. Some of those modifications are simply drilling a hole that's a little bit larger in front of the microphone element, or making electronic circuit changes. It sure would be nice if there was a potentiometer in there where you could just turn it and reset the deviation. Unfortunately, it doesn't have that. It's got an integrated circuit chip that is a burn once type, which sets the deviation, and there's no way of reprogramming that particular chip, so other means have to be taken. Okay. Once again, if you're hearing things you think shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode on your rig. Tell us how strong, what time, where you were located, and report that to either RFI, stands for Radio Frequency Interference, RFI@LIMARC.org, or abuse@LIMARC.org, either one of those that you can remember. The first person who checked in tonight was Rich, N2EO. And what's the latest with you, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet. A deviation, and there's no way of reprogramming that particular chip. Other means have to be taken. Okay.
Again, K2RIW, TechNet, LIMARC, N2EO.
Report that to. Go right ahead, Rich. We're hearing you very well.
Okay, Dick, very good. Wanted to ask, I've been considering different antennas for this spring. And one of the antennas I looked at on MFJEnterprises.com, it said doublet, 160 to 10 meters. And by the way, the price is excellent, $49. That's with the ladder line and the hang-up hook. And this is the thing, it's at 102 foot of wire. Now, I don't see how 102 foot can work on 160 meters. I think you need more like 260 foot. That's the first part of the question. The other thing, they said doublet, not dipole. Why do they use two names for the same thing? Back to net, and to the yoke.
Doublet versus dipole, I don't know. I think those are somewhat synonymous words. The fact that it's a thoroughly symmetric antenna and there's a left side and right side that looks the same, it's a double. That's a guess on my part, as you can tell. Now, a 160-meter antenna normally is around 260-some-odd feet long. By way of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, and you can get access to those by going to either of the websites, Mike 1 or Mike 2. Those are the KC2NJI and K1MJM websites. You can go to that. one is limarktechnet, .com. In either one of those, you will find an article by K2LIW about impedance matching a dipole. In there, you'll find the so-called Brown-Woodward curves. What those curves tell you is that once you know the length of the wire that constitutes your antenna, those curves will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get. And so I'm going to make a rough guess. 102 feet of wire on 160 meters is probably going to give you a resistive impedance of around 20 ohms, 10 ohms in that order. And it's going to give you an inductive, a capacitive reactance of around 1,000 ohms. If you're feeding your dipole slash doublet with open wire antenna, nice thing about open wire feed line, the nice thing about, let me drop, open wire, that cut. And so I'm going to make a rough, well, the nice thing about open wire feed line is that it can tolerate a very large standing wave ratio, and that roughly 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance and 20 ohms of resistance, it's probably a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. As long as your antenna tuner has enough dynamic range to it, you can definitely match that. Or you could, by way of a antenna analyzer, find out exactly what impedance you measure in the shack and build a simple L network that'll match that for you at your favorite frequency on 160. And the L network, you can easily design that by going to the Berkeley website. You simply Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, and impedance match. You'll come up with a website that once you plug in those numbers for what is the impedance of your particular antenna and what frequency you're on, they will give you 15 separate solutions of an L network, upside down L network, pi network, inverted pi network, T network, and so on. And you choose the one that you like. So by a simple impedance matching system that you add at the end of your transmission line, when it's open wire line, you can bring that crazy impedance of your antenna on 160 meters because it's the wrong length down to a nearly 1-to-1, so that you almost don't even need an antenna tuner. So if your antenna tuner runs out of range, there's a solution. And there's multiple other kinds of solution. So I am making a guess that MFJ is saying, yes, this antenna will work on this frequency range as long as you can handle those impedances. Let me drop. And so on. The one that you like. So matching system that you add at the end of your transmission line. And one of the things that's very hard to believe is that if you read the correct chapter of the antenna book by John Krause, W-A-J-K, one of the really classics, McGraw-Hill, 1950, a book called Antennas, and you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. In other words, you've taken a full dipole on, say, 80 meters, that should be 132 foot long, a 14-gauge wire, so to speak, and you start shrinking it down to smaller and smaller. As long as you can impedance match that highly reactive antenna because it's too small, once you bring it back into resonance, you'll get the exact same gain, the exact same effective capture area. Of course, that doesn't make common sense. But take my word for it, as long as you're using low-loss materials with an antenna that is the wrong size, particularly being too small, you never lose more than half a dB of the full dipole gain. Ain't that crazy? You never lose more than half a dB. It actually calculates to be something like 0.45 dB. And that 0.45 dB of loss is not loss of performance. It's just because the dipole pattern, the figure eight pattern, becomes a little bit fatter. You're still radiating essentially 100% of the energy. You're just smearing it a little bit wider, if you know what I mean. And then for broadside, you come down half a dB of gain. So the big characteristic you have to meet whenever you're building an antenna is it must hit resonance. I don't care if it's a small loop, a large loop, a multi-turn loop, a dipole is too small, a dipole is too big, whatever. You bring it into resonance, and you get full performance of gain and effective capture area. And of course, that doesn't make common sense. I understand that. What your eye sees, what the radio wave sees, is very, very different. You can tell that by the example that I've often given, and that is your Con Ed, your PSNG, PSENG, or your LIPA, or local wire of the power system on your block. That wire is at your altitude, directly across the street, in the direction of the guy you want to talk to on 80 meters in London. And you assume that that wire is going to cast a shadow on your antenna and drastically hurt your performance. And the answer is absolutely not. A full dipole on 80 meters has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. And you can trace that to the Bureau of Standards, if you know what I mean. That's a pretty secure piece of information. That piece of wire of Con Ed, the power wiring across the street, because it is not resonant, the actual area it has is the physical area that your eye sees. So you're casting a couple of square feet of shadow area onto your antenna on 80 meters that has an effective area of 8,500 square feet. That's very little difference. It's not even the width of the needle on your signal strength meter of an old-fashioned Collins receiver, if you know what I mean. So I am making a guess that MFJ is saying that as long as you've got enough a wide enough range on your impedance matching characteristics, and almost every one of us can do that, it's not rocket science to take an antenna with extremely high standing wave ratio and bring it down to a lower standing wave ratio by a whole bunch of techniques. Antenna tuner is one way. An L network, matching network, is another way. Changing the length of the transmission line so that the actual impedance you see in the shack comes into the good region of your particular antenna tuner. Every antenna tuner can tolerate very high standing wave ratios in a certain position on that Smith chart.
Repeater, time.
To take an antenna in a certain position on that Smith chart of all possible impedances. And because you're most likely your particular antenna doesn't fall into the good region, but by changing the length of the transmission line, you take the exact same standing wave ratio, you rotate it like you take that dot and you put your compass on that Smith chart, and now you rotate it clockwise as you add extra transmission line, and eventually it goes into the good region where your antenna tuner has more range and you can copy it and you can accommodate that particular antenna. So these are some of my guesses as to what's going on there, Rich. I haven't actually seen that ad. I haven't actually seen the device. But you tell us 102 feet long, that's sort of a compromised length, and any piece of wire in the air that you can force into resonance, no matter what shape it's got, as long as you can force it into resonance and you've used low-loss materials, you're going to radiate 98% of the radio energy you've got into space somewhere. Over to you, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Accommodate. So, these are some of...
Okay. Am I getting over there?
Yes, you are. Please proceed. I have an...
Okay, thank you, Dick. K2RIW.
You long?
And Y-Mark N2EO. Well, thank you very much, Dick. It says... I'll tell you one thing, the price is very attractive. $49.95, it's 102 feet of number 14 copper, and it's got fiberglass hang-up hook in the center, and I forget how many feet from ladder line, open wire ladder line, proceeded with. And I don't know if I'm going to go that way, but they also have a double extended set for about the same price. I'm just looking stuff over. And, Dick, I also wanted to bring up, I brought up last week, I'm going to need some help this spring when the weather thaws out and breaks, maybe April or May. Because I don't know, I guess most people know I'm diabetic, and as a result, I lost my right leg about a year ago. I'm an amputee. So if I can get a few guys over here to string this thing up for me, it would be very much appreciated. And in return, we have a barbecue here, a guest fire barbecue. I have a lady friend that lives here with me, Patricia. She's a pretty good cook. I'll ask her to please put up some hamburgers, hot dogs, maybe some sausages for the guys. Back to that, and to we go. Fuck you. Get it.
Minnesota. Rich is looking for an antenna-raising party in the spring when the weather gets good, which is inevitable, for putting up all of these sky wires and antlers that Rich is getting ready for with his Kenwood 2S2000 that maybe is on the way, maybe the MFJ doublet antenna, and so on. So, and good food is promised, maybe even pizza and Coke and whatever. No alcoholic beverages, though, until the antennas are up. All right, the next person who signed in was Tony, KC2UJL, and we'll be the judge, Tony. The main thing that this TechNet is trying to do is educate people on information they need to not only make all their radio equipment work, but in order for them to stay healthy so that they can become members of the ham radio clubs, the ham radio organizations where you've been there for 25 or 50 years. So we want to keep people alive so that they can get more and more of that DX. So give us your information, Tony. KC2UJL, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Fuck. It's true, sir. To be honest with you, the information I have, I saw on HBO about oncology and the enormous strides they've made in the curing of cancer. Cancer cells, doctors that are doing the opera experiments and stuff. I was going to put that information on the web tonight, but it can wait maybe for later on when you guys see getting involved with radio equipment. I just wanted to find out if that would be valuable enough to put out here. QSL.
Yeah, I think so. And when it comes to the subject of cancer, particularly with reference to radio operators, a whole lot of very poor information has been given out on the internet, among other places. The problem started way back in, let me pick a number, let me make a guess, 1905 or so, when people were doing experiments on antennas. They found that you put a radio signal into an antenna, it goes out into space in all directions. It radiates. Therefore, the process is perfectly proper to call that process radiation. And radiation, radiation, radio frequency radiation, perfectly good words. Until World War II came along and nuclear radiation suddenly came out. And then people make the inappropriate connection between nuclear and radio. Nuclear consists of atomic-sized particles coming out of that reaction or out of that substance at nearly the speed of light. They're extremely microscopic bullets that when they hit your body, they do damage. And if it does do enough damage to your DNA, it could potentially cause a cancer. So nuclear radiation, so-called ionizing radiation. Ionizing means that the smallest particle, the smallest photon, so to speak, has enough energy that when it hits you, can do damage. And nuclear energy does that. And the damage it does is accumulative. You absorb 1 millirem of nuclear radiation today and 1 millirem of nuclear radiation tomorrow, your total exposure is close to 2 millirem, so to speak. Whereas RF exposure is non-ionizing. The amount of energy in an RF wave is so small in each individual particle that until you get a huge amount of it, like what happens in your microwave oven, which, by the way, only creates heating, and there you can do cooking, but none of us have radio systems that can create anywhere near the amount of watts per square meter or watts per square centimeter as you can with a microwave oven. Your radio system can't do that. And the 60 years of study of radio has shown that it does not cause cancer. When a radio wave strikes a human being, it does nothing but create heating. That's the only thing they've been able to measure in 60 years of testing. And there were lots of people who have come up with all kinds of crazy stories. The most striking one is the one that took place in France about 2 years ago. And the story that took place in France, you can read about it in about 1.5 years ago in the monthly journal of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, the monthly journal called Antennas and Propagation. And there they describe a story of what happened in Reims, France, where a cell site was put up alongside of an apartment building. And once the cell site was placed there, the people in the apartment building started developing a lot of serious health effects, headaches and lack of concentration and stomach aches and couldn't sleep and couldn't concentrate and whatever. And they were putting up tinfoil on the windows on the side of the building toward the cell site. And they created a lawsuit. And the lawyer, the judge in that particular situation said that there is no evidence that the cell site is creating this grief that these people are suffering, but because there are so many people making such a big complaint, for the time being we will order the cell site to be removed in order to remove all this grief. And then the company putting up the cell site said, this is crazy. We had put up the tower, but there were no antennas on the top of the tower yet. This wasn't operational. It's obvious that all of those medical griefs of all of these residents of this apartment building was really psychosomatic. So there's a whole lot of information of poor reference of radio creating problems. And the other big example I give, let me drop, is that if you live directly next door to an operating cell phone base station, and your apartment, your bedroom on the second floor faced in that direction, and you're close as you can possibly get, and you measure the amount of radio signal entering your body at drive time, at rush hour, so to speak, when everybody's using their cell phone and calling their family saying, should I pick up a loaf of bread? And you make that measurement, and you compare it to what happens when you operate a cell phone up against your head a quarter of an inch away. Because of the way the inverse square law works, and because of that antenna pattern on that tower 150 foot high with its pancake pattern aimed down at the horizon, and because of the distances involved, when you actually go through the mathematics, you'll find that the cell phone against your head is giving you more radio signal into your body than being living directly next door to the cell phone base station. The next question is going to be, well, how much bigger? The answer is more than a million times stronger. The nearest portion of your head that's against that cell phone is receiving a number of watts per square centimeter, milliwatts per square centimeter, or specific absorption rate in watts per kilogram. When you go through the mathematics, the cell phone against your head is more than a million times stronger than if you lived directly next door to the cell phone base station and made the measurement during rush hour. Let me drop. And of course that sounds crazy. When you look at that cell site, you're looking at $500,000 worth of hardware. You're looking at tons of steel tower and antennas and cables and a base station below it with all the electronics in a building and kilowatts of energy going into it. It looks like it should be more dangerous than that thing in your hand called cell phone that's only a couple of ounces running on a battery. But because the distance is so different, it makes that change. Now, on Long Island, we've got a number of communities where people with a lot of enthusiasm and maybe a lot of charisma have convinced the residents that they're getting a lot of grief, similar to what happened to that apartment building in France. And so you can go to various websites that will give you information. The good news about the internet is there's a lot of information there. The bad news is you've got to sometimes filter it. If you went to the website that used to be in existence, I don't know if it still is, called BRAC, B-R-A-C-T. That stands for Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. In the township of Oyster Bay on Long Island, in the village of Bayville, a high percentage of that population has been convinced that all radio antennas are dangerous, and therefore they want all the antennas removed from their town, all cell phone antennas, all police antennas, all fire antennas, all emergency vehicle antennas and ambulance antennas. They want all antennas removed from their town and put in somebody else's town. An extremely unreasonable request. And they've been working on that for 3 or 4 years to try to accomplish that. They never will. I mean, in the modern age of 2015, so to speak, radio is here to stay. You're not going to be able to get rid of it because you have an opinion that it's that is dangerous. And the people in that village are sincere individuals. I've interviewed quite a few of them. Some of them are my relatives. protecting their children. They won't use the microwave oven when the children are in the house. They won't use their cell phone when the child is in the house. They won't use their Wi-Fi system. They won't turn on their computer when the child is in the house. And if they have to run their business with a cell phone, they go out to the car and drive away before using it. They're fairly sure they're protecting their children from what they think is a danger of radio frequency radiation. And so they're going to these extremes. If you actually study the amount of heating you get from a cell phone base station during drive time, you'd have to be 2.5 feet to 3 feet away from that antenna, standing on top of the fireman's hook and ladder, in order to be close enough to where you would exceed the threshold of grief, the maximum permitted exposure by current U.S. standards, which has been studied for, as I said, 60 years. The amount of heating you get from a cell phone base station at that distance is the same amount of heating you would get if you were 1 or 2 feet away from a 35-watt incandescent light bulb. So when the residents of Bayville are turning off all their radio equipment, they think they're protecting their children from radio interference, radio grief. They're protecting them from the heat of a 35-watt incandescent light bulb at a couple of feet. That's exactly what the real effect is. So as you can tell, there's a lot more to the story. There's a lot of misunderstanding here. We radio users... We radio users are the people with the smarts, the experience, the exposure, the knowledge that we should be trying to transmit to our neighbors, that radio is your friend. Radio, can anybody say absolutely positively no one has ever been damaged by exposure to a radio system? Of course not. You can't even say that clean water is absolutely positively safe in all situations, because there are college students that go through a hazing procedure where they do a competition as to who can drink the most amount of clean, cold water in a short period of time. And a few of those hazing students at colleges die each year from overexposure of tremendous amounts of water. Some kind of an acidosis-like situation occurs. Too much of anything is bad. So there is nothing in the world that's absolutely positively safe if you use it in the worst possible way. But 99% of all the ways we use radio is absolutely safe, obvious by the FCC standards, the standards of the IEEE C95 report. The American National Standards Institute, ANSI, has this paper you can read called the C95 report. Let me drop it. Which represents a 60-year study of all the best institutions, all the best research organizations and testing laboratories in the United States. There's a similar document for the Bureau of Radiological Health in the United Kingdom and so on. Throughout the world, there are very similar documents that are doing very similar studies, and they all have the same information. And I'll admit that that document is quite technical, not easy to read, but it's got 1,000 references, represents a whole lot of testing over a whole lot of years, looking for all the effects of radio exposure to human beings, animals, plants, and whatever. And the bottom line is, they have found nothing but the thermal effect. Radio energy, when it's when it hits a human being, depending on what frequency, the portion that gets absorbed gets turned into heat. For 60 years, they've been looking for the non-thermal effect and have never found it. There are people who think that the radio is going to be changing your chemistry. It's going to be injecting signals into your nervous system and creating twitching of the muscles and whatever. They think all these kinds of things. And the answer is no, they can't find it. So cancer and radio are almost opposite ends of the spectrum. We put it together sometimes, and we shouldn't. And that's alarmist. Many of the people writing the articles have an emotional response to a set of words they've been given, and it's in many cases an old wives' tale. And so you got to do some filtering, and it's quite possibly not real most of the time. We're going to come back to you, Tony. Next person on the question on the list was Mr. Wires, KC2, Foxtrot Yankee, and go right ahead and give us your information or your question, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, thank you. From Kilo Charlie 2, Fox Yankee Yankee. Well, I wanted to ask you about your experience receiving transmissions from the moon landing. I was wondering what type of equipment you used. Did you capture voice and pictures? And I was reading about, was there any type of problem with doing that? One of the websites I read said that any information you disclosed would have to comply with the Communications Act of 1934, but I'd like to hear a little bit about your experience doing that. KC2FYY.
Yeah, the easiest way you can find out quite a bit about what took place with a group of guys on Long Island in 1971 on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 is by looking at the June issue, 1972, QST Magazine, which is in the archives of the ARRL, an article by W4HHK and T2RIW. The article is entitled Houston, This is Apollo. So the June issue has the article showing you the equipment we set up. The August issue shows the article on how to build the antenna we used. It was a 12-foot diameter dish antenna, homebrew, made out of chicken wire. No, it wasn't chicken wire. It was aluminum. It was copper screening. Copper screening, 12-foot diameter dish, and a parabolic dish in those days was kind of expensive, so we built our own out of aluminum tubings that were being bent like a bow and arrow, 18 pieces of tubing, as I remember. 12 or 18 it was, yes. Half-inch diameter tubing. That made a 12-foot diameter dish with the right shape after we did a little bit of adjusting. A homemade pea horn out of an American paint can and a Scottish oatmeal can because they were round cans to make a feed horn of the right diameter. Let me drop. The command service module for Apollo spacecraft had a downlink astronaut audio frequency of 2287.5 megahertz. In those days, 2.285 megahertz was pretty high frequency in those days. Nowadays, we just call it 802.11 if you want to know, you know, if you know what I mean. It's a kind of old hat nowadays. And I did use a spectrum analyzer that I was working on. I was on the development program at Airborne Instruments Laboratory to design their so-called Model 707 spectrum analyzer. That became the front-end tuning device that tuned the 2287.5 frequency. That brought it down to the first IF of 221 megahertz. I had a converter from the 221 megahertz down to a ham radio piece of equipment that actually listened to astronaut audio. The actual signal coming from the command module when they were at the moon was, as I remember, approximately a 10-watt signal. And when they were on the high-gain antenna, we had no trouble, well, not too much trouble listening to the signal. It was a very weak signal. But with the 12-foot dish, we received enough of it to get something like 3 or 4 hours worth of astronaut audio on Apollo 15 and something like 15 hours worth of astronaut audio on Apollo 16. Exciting stuff, if you know what I mean. When it comes to the legality of eavesdropping in that manner, let me drop. I first wrote a letter to NASA asking for the frequencies. They were positive that they were using the Goldstone dish, among other antennas, a 240-foot dish. They didn't think we had the resources to listen to astronaut audio, so they told us all the frequencies, the method, the modulation. I also asked them, if I receive astronaut audio, would I be violating the Communication Act of 1934? And you read the Communication Act of 1934, it talks about interstate and intercountry communication. When you're talking to somebody, when you listen to somebody from outer space, is that going across state lines? Is it going across country lines? It turns out the wording of the Communication Act is not clear. I asked the NASA people, would I be violating any laws if I revealed what I heard? I did not get an answer to that, even though I got a letter back giving me the information I wanted. They didn't answer that. There is no answer. We used good taste. In other words, we told people what we heard, which it wasn't embarrassing. The most embarrassing thing, I guess, would be where some of the conversations that took place when they were not connected to the networks that we were listening to were somewhat humorous, but very understandable, if you know what I mean. The most exciting statement that I heard was on Apollo 16, Mattingly, Young, and Duke with the three astronauts. Let me drop. And when they were going to go around the moon in a clockwise manner for the first time, they were going to go behind the moon for the very first time, and NASA was going to get loss of signal. As they went around the moon, clockwise, top view, the moon was casting a shadow down onto the Earth, you could say. That shadow, you could say, started in California and swept across the United States in the next 30 seconds or so, because of the rate at which they're moving, the shadow was sweeping across the state. So therefore, NASA had a dropout of astronaut audio, but I was still hearing astronaut audio for the next, I'm guessing it was about 10 or 15 seconds, and we could recalculate how long that takes. Mattingly, Young, and Duke had a real good sense of humor. They knew they were about to go behind the moon for the first time. They had to do a burn of their rocket engine on the backside of the moon in order to put them into lunar orbit. And so they were reading up all kinds of numbers to make sure their inertial platform was properly aligned and all the instrumentation was all set up right. So a bunch of numbers are being read up back and forth. And I remember, I guess it was Mattingly saying on the radio link downlink, saying that, okay, on mission elapsed time, so-and-so hours, I'm going to do a burn for X number of seconds in order to put us into lunar orbit. And he asked the question, NASA, do I make that burn toward the moon or away from the moon? He carefully timed that question, a joke question, right at the instant that they were going to get dropout. So NASA Goldstone got a dropout. They didn't hear the rest of his question. I was hearing them. They knew that they were out of communication range, and I'm hearing them laughing to each other. What are they going to do with that one? Something along those lines. And I was hearing that information. Real good sense of humor, as you can tell. So this gives you some of the information I think you're looking for, Wires, and a fun project. We were going to do it also.
Repeater, timeout.
We were also going to do it on Apollo 17, but we got busy with another project and it didn't take place. And Apollo 17, as I remember, took place in like December in the wintertime. And setting up that antenna outdoors on a tripod on a high wind, windy day would be kind of difficult. The good news is that antenna was homebrew and not very hard, not very heavy, and not very expensive. The bad news is anything more than a 10-mile-an-hour wind, the thing would wave around in the wind, and you couldn't keep this 3-degree beam with them aimed at the spacecraft or aimed at the moon, if you know what I mean. You probably got some further questions on this one. Wires, it's, as I said, it was a fun project. KC2, FYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, no, I'll take a look at the old QSTs and do some more reading, and then if I have questions, I'll return, but I appreciate the information. 73, we'll be listening. KC2FYY.
Yeah, at the time that we did that, one other guy in California was also doing it, and also Paul Wilson, W4HHK, in Tennessee, was also doing it. And so it was kind of rare in those days, because 2.8 gigahertz was considered a pretty high frequency, required some unusual equipment. And in order to make it work well, I had to borrow a parametric amplifier from Airborne Instruments Laboratory to use as the front end. So I had a feed horn that was worth $2 worth of food cans, connected to a $5,000 parametric amplifier, connected to a borrowed spectrum analyzer, which in those days sold for $12,000, and the rest of it was my ham radio equipment. You'll see a picture of that in that June issue 1972 QST. And so I got a lot of mileage out of that project, so to speak. When that article in my company newspaper described what we did with company equipment during off hours, I became kind of popular. I eventually got on a first-name speaking basis with the president of the company. He had to go to corporate headquarters in Milwaukee, and he borrowed one of my tape recordings of astronaut audio and played it for the other people he was meeting at corporate headquarters, showing what the unusual engineers back on Long Island, what they were doing in their spare time as hobbyists. Let me drop. And so I met some interesting people. Well, by the way, I did get a chance to take a trip paid for by the company when we did have to visit a vendor in Texas. I just happened to take a side trip off to Houston, the Space Center in Houston, Texas, and I gave them a letter ahead of time telling them what I had listened to, gave them a copy of my tape recording, and they talked to me very nicely, introduced me to various engineers. I had a chance to sit on the lunar rover car when it was not operational. The tires were pretty worn down because various people had sat on their example in Houston. I did see astronaut Stuart Reuser under while he was going through astronaut training. And as it said, I had a chance to talk to a number of the engineers at Houston, and they were kind of amazed that such simple equipment, when the high-gain antenna was being used, would be able to listen to astronaut audio. When they weren't able to use the high-gain antenna on the spacecraft, which was a quad dish that hung off to one side of the space capsule, when they had to go over to the omnidirectional antenna, which was much lower in gain, it was below threshold for me. The Goldstone dish in the Mojave Desert of California, at Goldstone, which is really in the Fort Irwin Army bases where it's actually located, that 240-foot dish, let me drop it, I could calculate how much more dB of gain, but it probably had 20 dB more gain than my little 12-foot dish, and as such, they could hear the astronaut audio on the omnidirectional antenna. I could not. But the good news is that a high percentage of the time, they were on the high-gain antenna throughout the mission, and therefore, it was above threshold for my much more simple equipment. And I am kind of curious, how did you find out that I had done that, Wires? Because it doesn't get mentioned very often these days. Who first brought that to your attention? KC2FYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is Kilo Charlie 2, Fox Yankee Yankee. Well, I was just doing some probing around the internet, and you along with W4HHK were mentioned, but they don't give a lot of detail about what you were, your equipment or what you were doing. You just kind of mentioned that you had received the transmissions, and that was about it. So I just wanted to hear it from the source, and now you've given me an opportunity to look at some more in QST. And I'm curious, with your recordings, have you digitized them, and someday will you share them with the ham community? KC to FYY.
No, I haven't, and maybe I will not. It would take a lot of hours to do it. It really is, let me think, 1971. That's 45-year-old information. It's really old news. The recordings, some of them are pretty noisy, kind of ratty. It's like listening to quite a bit of the recordings are like listening to a FM signal that is 80% noise, 20% audio. Occasionally they were stronger than that. How well we were able to aim our antenna was one of the factors. How well the astronauts were aiming their high-gain antenna at the Earth is one of the factors. And the person who did it better than me on Apollo 17 was Steve Meath in, was it Palo Alto, California? Let me think now. No, not Palo Alto. He was north of Los Angeles. I can't think of the name of the town. And I met Steve Meath and went to visit him. And I can't think of his call letters right now. W6 something or other. Steve Meath had used a 18-foot diameter dish that was set up on an SCR-584 pedestal. He had precise aiming, he has better noise figure than me, and he received astronaut video, high-speed video, when on the way home, they had a press conference with the president on the way home on Apollo 17. He received that astronaut video at his home in California on his 18-foot dish. So by the time Apollo 17 came along, which was around December of 1971, He was better equipped than we were. So there were three guys in the United States that I know of that were doing that reception. Let me drop. Also, the radio telescope in Darmstadt, Germany. Can't think of the name of the Professor Knighton right now that was doing that. He was using this large radio telescope to also listen to astronaut audio. So it was a bit on the rare side to listen to the command service module of and the lunar module. We, by the way, did listen to also the lunar module, the lunar rover car, and the ALSEP packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Pulse Package, ALSEP. When they deposit that package on the moon and set up that antenna and aim at the Earth, we were also given those frequencies, and we could hear the carrier of each of those tones, of each of those transmitters. There are a number of amateurs who have listened to various spacecraft at various distances. Some of the spacecraft that have traveled to Mars during the distance, during the time that the spacecraft, let me drop. During the time the spacecraft left Earth and was on its way to Mars, a number of amateurs have listened to that downlink carrier signal. They usually don't have enough signal-to-noise ratio to demodulate the information, but at least the carrier can be listened to. And most of those interplanetary spacecraft don't use the S-band signal, that 2.3 gigs, I'm going to call it. They use the X-band signals at 8.5 gigs. You get more gain out of an antenna with the higher frequency. So a number of amateurs have listened to the 8.5 gig downlink frequency of spacecraft on the way to Mars. They may have even done it with a spacecraft on the way to Venus. So later than 1972, other amateurs started doing this kind of work. It's you could say it's a subset of radio astronomy to listen to such interesting weak signals like coming from such a long distance away. It's a real QRP, a real DX, if you know what I mean. I could sit here and dream, let me drop it. I could sit here and dream as to whether or not I would ever be able to listen to the downlink signal from Voyager. Voyager's out there 130 astronomical units, roughly 12 billion miles, transmitting something like 10 watts of signal at 8.5 gigahertz. Boy, is that DX. In miles per watt, wow. Nobody's ever going to top that. And so I could sit here and dream about whether or not I could listen to that signal. And with the Goldstone dish, 240-foot diameter, they have to go down to something like a 50 hertz bandwidth phase lock loop receiver with a state-of-the-art Mesa front-end low noise amplifier in order to listen to that signal because of this great distance. And there are various people who used to predict that a radio signal going that far would get tired and that it would experience a loss because of the number of molecules that are in space in between here and there. All kinds of predictions were made, and all of it says no. That signal, once you launch a signal, it goes to every cubic meter or cubic centimeter of this universe. The only thing left to discuss is it above threshold of the receiving equipment you're using right now? A radio signal goes everywhere. It doesn't stop, and there is no place where it doesn't go. Let me drop. And the best example of that is I worked at the Benfield Anechoic Facility at Edwards Air Force Base near California, near Palmdale, California. I keep forgetting the name of the town that's slightly north of that. Anyhow, this $63 million anechoic chamber has a screen room that is known to be 100 decibels of shielding. Every radio signal from the outside world getting in or out of that chamber is going to be shielded by 100 dB. So you think you're in a perfect, well-constructed screen room where no signal can get in there. And the answer is no. The signals get in there. They're just 100 dB weaker, but they still go there. No matter where you go, the signal is there. Even under the water, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. It never goes to zero. That's the magic of radio. That's the whole science of radio astronomy. super weak signal, Lee's reception, like some low energy emitter.